Welcome to Answers Withheld, a podcast about the big questions that kids, and let's be honest, adults too, ask about God, Judaism, and our place in the world. We definitely do not have all the answers, but we hope we can help you with language and framework so you can engage meaningfully with these questions. I'm Rabbi Shai Held. I'm joined today by Rabbi Brad Artson, Vice President of the American Jewish University and Dean of its Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies, and perhaps more importantly to me, an old friend and colleague whom I greatly respect. Today's question, one of the few Jews, I think, who has really engaged that conversation in a deep and ongoing way, is you, Brad. So I'm especially grateful to have you on this podcast today. Thank you.
I'm very happy to be here with you, Shai. Thanks for engaging in this conversation.
I want to ask you the question in the following way. Imagine a six-year-old asks you this question, and then imagine a 25-year-old asks you. Did God really create the world in 6 days?
So when I first graduated rabbinical school, I took a congregation in South Orange County in Mission Viejo. And I was there for 10 years. This is the period that my mother refers to as, quote, when I was a real rabbi, unquote. And I used to have this habit. I would go out to the preschool kids, because we had a wonderful preschool, and I would say to the kid, quick, tell me what that tree is telling you. And the thing about a four-year-old is they always could. They knew exactly what the tree was telling them. And here would be the grown-up way to screw that up. The grown-up way to screw that up would be to say, are you psychotic? Do you really think trees talk? You have to trust the kid knowing that there are truths deeper than true and false. And our education system beats that out of people. So what's a kid asking me when they ask, was the world really created in 6 days? I think they're asking, are there lessons in this book that I should base my life on? So I wouldn't give a frontal answer to the question, because that's a grown-up black and whiteness that would impose on the kid. What I would say is, I totally believe the world is not an accident. I believe that our lives are an answer to a question we've been given from beyond. And that what the Torah is telling us is that everything we do has purpose and is connected to that big thing, including your life right now.
You know, it's interesting to me that you say that a six-year-old is really asking you about whether the stories in this book or in this collection of books makes a claim on them. In my experience of being a parent, when they're six, they actually are asking you some version of, I have been told two very different stories, and I don't know how to either make sense with or live with the sense that they both must be true. And this is my first foray into asking you to help me think about different levels and kinds of truth.
Exactly.
That's what I hear in a six-year-old question. A 25-year-old is asking the question you're asking, I think, which is like, wait, this stuff is not earth science, so what is it? What is this book? What is the genre of this book? Why am I reading this? Is this some kind of like myth or fable? If this is a story that makes a claim on me, what is the nature of that claim?
Yeah. Notice you just said the same thing twice, right? Your six-year-old is using six-year-old language to say, this book isn't true the way other books are. What is it? And that's what your 26-year-old is saying.
Yeah, agreed.
The one time that did happen to me, I had a preschool kid who asked me, you know, when I'm at home, I read books about dinosaurs and I watch Barney. And then I come to preschool and the dinosaurs are gone, right? And that kid, 5 years old, already knew that some grown-up was lying to him, right? He didn't know what it was, but something weird is going on. There are no dinosaurs at the synagogue preschool, lots of dinosaurs at home. And so he asked the rabbi, what's going on? That's kind of the question you're using the how many days of the week to answer.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting. You know, I was thinking about how unchild-friendly a way what I'm about to say really is, but what a child is actually already asking is, what is the genre of this book?
See, you're back to your 26-year-old again.
Yeah, no, it's true.
I think what they're asking is, can I count on it?
Yeah.
Can I rely on it? Which is what I answered, but I'm not going to answer it with literalist language, because that's already losing the fight, I think.
Right. So right? What I have sometimes said to kids is, no, I don't believe the world was created in 6 days. And by the way, I'm pretty convinced the Torah doesn't either. Right? That's not what the Torah is telling you. The Torah wants us to think about what it means for the world not to be an accident, what it means for the world to have someone behind it, what it means for us to be alive. That's what the Torah is really asking.
Okay, that's fine. And that's a good answer. I guess I still want to step inside the story when I talk to kids. Mm-hmm. I want to do that with grownups too, but grownups have so many guardrails up and so many walls that it's harder to do that. So with adults, I kind of lean into borderline blasphemy, and that makes me reliable, and then I can say the pious things that I really think. But kids, I want to talk from the inside. I want to talk about, what is this story about?
I have found with adults that one of the most powerful ways to get them inside of Genesis 1 is to say, bracket for a minute everything you know about what this Jewish thinker or that Jewish thinker says. What does it mean to be created in the image of God?
Mm.
And the things people say are often astonishing.
Yes.
Then I have the hard job, because I believe it's my job to do this, of saying, you know, those are all beautiful and powerful. They're not what Bereishit itself means. Bereishit has some specific ideas in mind. And then that's a kind of unfolding of the ongoing conversation of Judaism. But I don't know what it is about that question. I find that it peels defenses extremely powerfully.
Yeah.
People will start talking about what is most precious to them about being human. When I ask, what do you think Tzelem Elohim is
before, sure.
Then they say stuff that's incredibly moving.
Yes.
And I then have to say to them, actually, let's talk about what the textual meaning of this idea is, and then let's build out into later Jewish thought.
Okay, so, and that's where we differ, because I go in the opposite direction. I don't want to start with the pshat, because so many people in the modern age use the contextual meaning as a way of walking out the door. And what they haven't learned how to do, because frankly, our literature classes kill it in them. You know, I majored in literature. I love literature. Not once did a professor in my college say, as we finished a novel, and how did it change your life? What did it make you realize?
Well, that's what I feel our job is.
I understand. So, but the thing is, I've been trained in contextual. What's the dates of the author's life? Who did the author know? What class were they part of? What were their political ideas? Blah, blah, blah. And then you stop before you get to the actual questions that the author wrote the book for. How's the author trying to mess with your mind? How's the author trying to elevate your soul? What new insights does that author want you to walk away with? What should you do once you have those insights? Like you ask that class in a literature room or in a conference of professors of literature, and you've just stepped outside of your profession. We live there, right? So what I want to do is I want to start both with the 6-year-old and the 26-year-old, and frankly, the 46-year-old. I want to start with this book saying, its original historical meaning is not why it's Torah. Its original historical meaning is why there are departments of ancient Near Eastern studies. And that's great. But what I want to focus on right now is, what is the Holy One saying to you through this story? Because that's why you're reading it, and that's why it's a bestseller, right? What does it say now? And then after we've established that God speaks through these stories, through how we resonate to those stories, then I might point out things from the Iron Age that add meaning to that. Look at the history of the story. Look at the way it was originally interpreted. Look at this statue we found. Right? That's all great, but that's, for me, secondary. The first thing I need to do with Western-educated people is crack the hole through their education that has taught them that you never, ever ask about literature, how should this change my life?
Right. So I just want to say one thing about what you just said about shot in the Bible and why it comes last for you. To me, Genesis 1 is a spectacular example of how actually historical awareness allows you to see what the author is saying. I never learned that in rabbinical school, but I think when you understand what the image of God means in the ancient world, and that only kings are images of God, and then you see that every human being on the face of the earth, without exception, regardless of gender, is an image of God, whoa, that's enough to really take your breath away. That'll set your heart on fire. And that, I think, you know, that is really rooted in the pshat. By the way, it's rooted in a pshat that my day school teachers didn't know because they refused to read anything about the ancient world. They didn't know what Tzelem Elohim meant in the Bible. They honestly didn't know.
Absolutely. Look, I love studying archaeology, ancient Near Eastern history. I agree. And for me, that adds so much to the study of Tanakh and Torah. So we're not disagreeing about that. We're talking strategy. And I think that most of the people who come to study at an adult level, they've been through a Western education sufficiently that they don't know how to have an emotional connection to a great text. It's been trained out of them, I think. So I'm interested in keeping it alive in kids as long as possible, and I'm interested in training adults to reopen themselves in that way.
I want to move us from talking above the text, as it were, to talking in it. So what does it mean to be created? What are we saying when we say God brought us, and the world for that matter, into being? What does it mean to you to say that?
I'm struggling to put language to it. I think that the biggest intrusion into my life, I went from being an atheist to being a pretty simple believer in college. And that was a kind of recognition for me that meaning and morality are not reducible to a human construct. It's not just biochemistry. It's not just mechanics. That there's something we are meeting that is not from us. And the argument I would have with my atheist family or friends was, you know, on the one level, you argue that morality is just human consensus. But you would be deeply offended if I told you that there are more Nazis than there are Jews, and therefore, if it's consensus, it's not immoral. But you know that's not right, because, you know, my atheist relatives live their life as though there's an absolute code of good and evil, and they're very clear about what it is. It's all about human dignity, right? And no matter how many people want to tighten and limit and constrain human dignity, my atheist family thinks they're objectively wrong. And I would say I do too, but I have an intellectual framework for that, right? That's because I think there's someone we meet who is the author of right and wrong. And it's mediated through our culture and we understand it through our human eyes, but there's a real meeting and a response, and that's what goodness is. And that's what drove me to turn to God as an atheist. And then I started having experiences of the divine, right? And those experiences reinforced my intuition that there's someone out there who would like to meet us, who would like to engage with us. And Jewish tradition for me is an elaborate echo chamber of our ancestors who are doing that engagement and therefore have something to teach me. Right? That I don't have to invent this on my own. I can benefit from incredibly intuitive people who've come before me, who've left these incredible, eloquent records. All right. So how would you make that same claim? How would you distinguish between, I don't know, a science text, a science description of how the world came into be, and the Torahs?
Yeah, I think that my response to this is actually extremely similar to yours, just in, not surprisingly, just in maybe perhaps slightly different language. What I think it means to say that the world is created is most fundamentally to say it's not an accident. There is purpose to it. The world has a purpose, and there is a consciousness that underlies it and has a purpose for it. What it means for me to be created is, to borrow and critique a phrase from Bertrand Russell, I am not merely a collocation of atoms. I am not just, you know, a bunch of physical processes. And what it means to be a self, all those things are also true, but they do not exhaust the meaning of being human. The meaning of being human, for example, includes the sense that I am obligated and responsible. I don't think biochemistry can ever explain how powerfully real my sense of obligation to other people is or ought to be, right? There is something about being human that turns me to a sense that it is more than just that. The one argument for the existence of God that I always find myself thinking about is the moral argument. And the moral argument essentially says, if you are a moral realist, meaning you think that morality is objectively real, you know, it's hard to tell that story without some kind of transcendent entity that you and I call God. It's very hard to tell that story. Now, do I think that's a knockdown, drag-out argument? Of course not. First of all, you could not be a moral realist, even though I think very few people, as you indicated, can function without effectively being moral realists. But okay, you cannot be a moral realist, or you can argue with some moral philosophers that there are ways to be a moral realist without believing in God. I personally have never found those stories compelling. Maybe another way of putting this, like a very different way of framing all this, is I don't think people come to believe or not believe in God or in creation by arguments. I think in a way, there are stories we tell about the world. There's a naturalistic story or a series of naturalistic stories where science explains almost everything. And then there are religious, theological stories where there's a whole other dimension that is beyond science's reach or ken. I've always found that I can see myself in the latter story and don't see myself at all in the former story. When Daniel Dennett says in the New York Times, I'm a robot, you're a robot, deal with it, I don't recognize myself in that story because my experience of the world is I'm a human being, you're a human being, we have obligations to each other. I find that religion is a much more powerful way to explain that experience than kind of reductive naturalism is.
I wrote a book on science and religion. And I teach it in my introduction to Jewish philosophy.
You teach your book, you mean, or you teach your...
No, we talk about the interface of religion and science, and I indicate to the students that they'd probably get a better grade if they bought several copies of my book and showed me the receipt. There is a conceit that many scientists have, not because they're scientists, but because of their metaphysics that they don't know they have, that they think that science answers all questions. And so I just want to say a word about that. Science is one of the most profound techniques for advancing human knowledge that we have ever come up with. It's extraordinarily, it's unparalleled in its success. And science is great for those things that are replicable, public, and testable. But the claim that there's nothing outside of what's public and replicable and testable is itself neither public nor replicable nor testable, which means the claim that science answers all questions is itself a non-scientific claim.
Another way of putting that, the dismissal of metaphysics is a metaphysics claim.
Correct. But what that means is there is actually realms of important things that are not answerable by science. And then scientists have as much a right to have an opinion about them as we do, we other people, but it's not science, even if a scientist says it. I have a friend who's a professor of physics, and he thinks the world is a big empty machine. And he called me one day because he had to decide whether or not to send his kid to a private Jewish school or the local public school. And I said to him, I don't know why you're calling me. You think that you're just a machine and that every outcome is just the sum total of what came before it. So just kick her out of your house and she'll wind up in the right school because there's no choice, is there? And he wanted to hang up on me because that's really aggravating when a theologian points out that you don't live your life according to your own ideas. But he doesn't. This is a guy who believes the world is a machine, a simple string of cause and event and effect, and yet he wants to talk about what school he should send his daughter to because he knows.
Because no one lives like a determinist.
We're free.
Right.
And we make choices, and our choices do have consequences, but we're not trapped by the past. That, to me, to get back to our original story, that's how I read Genesis. I read Genesis and I say, what's it teaching me? What's it telling me? It's saying a couple things that I would stake my life on, even if I think it is factually false, right? But only a clod reads a story, you know, was there a bull named Ferdinand and did he actually refuse to fight in a bullfight? Obviously, anyone who reads that story that way should have their library card taken away from them. Is there an elephant named Horton? And did he actually hear a who? Right? Are you kidding me? A person's a person, no matter how small. I would stake my life on that too. And by the way, that Horton hears a who is a ripoff of the book of Genesis, from whence that idea comes.
Brad, let me ask you this question. Are you saying that the Torah is true only in the same sense as Ferdinand or Horton hears a who are true?
I can only answer that question if you take out only, right? Is Torah true the way that Horton and Ferdinand are true? Absolutely. It is no less true than those stories because the outer garment is necessary to teach the inner message. I would stake my life on the truth of the Torah. But I don't think it happened historically.
Yeah, I think that where I would take issue or differ a little bit is that I still think the Torah reflects the Word of God in a way that Dr. Seuss or Ferdinand do not. That there is something about the story that makes it unique. But the larger point, I think I would make your point in a slightly different way. Truth is not reducible to empirical truths.
Agreed.
Ultimately, right, that's why the question of earth science is simply not the Torah. It's a category mistake. To ask how to reconcile the Torah with paleontology is to make a category mistake, is to insist that the Torah be something that it is fundamentally not and never aspired to be.
Agreed. And let me just say one thing about how I think the Torah is different. I mentioned that the Torah, out of the blue, comes up with the idea that all people have worth and that the divine is interested in all people. There's not a literature of its time that did that. There's not a literature of its time that said you have to pay workers on time, that you have to care for the widow and the orphan. There's just a billion ways that the Torah, in unprecedented ways, launches an entirely new insight about what it means to be human, what it means to build a culture. The greatness of literature is, on the other hand, derivative. Right? You couldn't have written Horton Hears the Who without the book of Genesis and the book of Leviticus. They're just, it's, you know, I joke with my students that, you know, Harry Potter, the best-selling book, is about a kid who is raised not by his actual parents, finds out at some point he's in the wrong place. He has these insights and abilities that are uncanny and unlike the people around him. And then he discovers a community of people who are just like him, but there's this evil demonic force that he has to defeat in order to be able to bring about real life and go to a place where there are others like him. And I say, am I talking about Harry Potter? Am I talking the book of Exodus, which Harry Potter is a retelling of? Right? I really do believe that most of the great stories of literature are different disguises for the original insights of Torah. And the way you're framing it is that God percolates differently through Torah than Horton Hears a Who. I agree with that. It is different because Horton Hears a Who is standing on the shoulders of the biblical tradition.
Stephen Jay Gould, the paleontologist, was famous for this idea of non-overlapping magisteria. That is to say that science had authority to speak in one way and religion had authority to speak in another way. You know, so for example, I think if I have a vague recollection that he gives this example. Science answers the question of why we look so much like apes. Religion answers the question of, now that we're here, what are our responsibilities? And other scientists have said, and for that matter, theologians, they're not non-overlapping magisteria. They're partially overlapping magisteria, right? We believe in magisteria that talk to each other. Francis Collins, you know, famously makes a version of this argument, right? Of course, that still requires a lot of careful thinking about where they do and don't interpenetrate. And, you know, obviously, I suspect all of us might come to slightly different conclusions about that.
So Hilary Putnam was the person who famously took on David Hume and others. You know, that dichotomy that it's one is about the how and one is about the why, that facts are permeated by moral choices. What you decide to research, how you decide to research it, you know, what you think is important enough to talk about, these are not factually generated questions. So your exploration of and labeling and description of facts is permeated by values and by claims. And your assertion of claims is informed by your facts, how you understand what the world is or what just happened or what it. So I think that the notion that these are ironclad divisions and you can keep them, you can make religion and science civil with each other because they never, ever touch, is the distortion I was aiming at.
I want to be clear that the Torah is not telling us how God created the world, but I do think the Torah means quite factually, if you will, that God did create the world. You know, I think often about, if I'm right about this, you know, I'm about to say something about Maimonides, which means, you know, more than, you know, I could be wrong about anything. But when I talk about Maimonides, of course I could be wrong. But I think that when it comes to creation, Maimonides thinks the only thing we can know for sure is that the fact that the world exists is attributable to God. Everything else is interpretation. So for me, I take Bereishit Aleph literally, if you will, in the sense that I think the world exists because of God, who is not being, but the source of being, right? That's what I think the Torah is telling us. The world is not God. God is not the world. The world exists because of God. Everything else stems from that. I mean, I'm reminded, and Brad, I'm sure you know much more about this than I do. There's a very interesting debate among philosophers and theologians when scientists arrive at, I don't know if it's a consensus exactly, but at a virtual consensus that the Big Bang happened at a moment in time and that therefore the world has a starting point. So you had some Christian theologians jumping up and down saying, this verifies or at least strongly supports the idea that the world is created. And then you had other philosophers and theologians say, stop confusing cosmology for theology, right? It doesn't matter. The fact is that the world exists because of God. No amount of research in your lab is going to verify or disconfirm that. To me, I have a lot of sympathy for the second view, even though I'm intrigued by the first and don't understand enough of the science to have an opinion really about either. But I think the Torah really means there is a world because God wanted there to be. And more than that, we are here because God wanted us to be. That, you know, to use a phrase Brad has used a couple times, I would stake my life on that.
So we're asking people a much more complicated place, which is there's no way to tell a story without details, but the point of the story is seldom in the details, right? So that the universe is purpose-driven, that there is nothing that is not a manifestation of the divine, that there is an unfolding and we are called to be partners in that unfolding. And I believe that the Torah is the best vehicle for communicating that, although it does that with a lot of details that I don't necessarily think are true in that same historical way.
I never, as a Jew, want to say the details don't matter, because both in the way we read texts and in the way we live out our religious lives, details are enormously important. The question, I think, is important for what? So I want to read Bereishit Aleph, Genesis 1. I want to pay attention to everything I could possibly learn from every formulation and every detail of that text. But I am trying to learn Torah, not earth science. And that's really, on some level, the fundamental question. I think there are, though, some striking images in the Torah that in recent years have come to mean a lot to me. This is really not to differ with you, just to say, the Bible scholar Terry Fredheim points out something really magnificent. He says, it's really interesting that God does not say, let there be grass. Rather, God says, let the earth bring forth grass. Tatshe ha'aretz deshe. He says, we have been taught that Genesis 1 is about immediate divine creation. And it is in some ways, but it's also about immediate divine creation. It is about a God who calls upon creation to develop itself.
That's right.
It is about a God who asks the world to make more of life, flourishing, etc. And that, I think, is a really powerful way, for me, of kind of thinking about, again, not in some literal sense, but thinking about evolution in a biblical frame, right? It's about the earth bringing forth grass.
Yes. God is summoning a partnership with all of creation and with every instance of creation to now join me in this endeavor. Be godlike in being part of it. So only God can launch the whole thing, and only God is permeating the whole thing. But every entity, not just biological entities, but every entity within creation is busy replicating and complexifying in a way that partners with the divine. If we're simply trying to have a cartoon version of a war between evolution and religion, we're going to miss out in the ways in which, as Rav Kook noted, the Torah is itself a blueprint of evolution.
Genesis 1 sort of makes it sound like God created the world, finished, and sort of went upstairs to take a nap. Other texts, like Psalm 104, known to Jews as Barchi Nafshi, the Psalm for Rosh Chodesh, for the beginning of the month, make it sound like creation is something God is actively involved in all the time. It's hard work, and God is anything but vacationing. And that makes me think about the idea that you find in various medieval Jewish philosophers, for example, that if at any point God withdrew from the world, it would collapse and disappear. That is, that the world is ongoingly dependent on God, right? It's not deism. It's something very different from that. I just want to hear you talk about that a little bit, because I know that's something you've thought about.
Yes. So look, I think that Jewish liturgy, including the book of Bereishit, speaks about this ongoing nature. And I want to draw our attention to the beginning, right? That there's tohu vavohu. God doesn't create out of nothing. God creates out of chaos. And that the moving of chaos to cosmos never ends. It never starts and it never ends. It's just always what God is doing. So there's always becoming. Being is a logical abstraction. It doesn't exist. There's just becoming. And God's helping move and then seeking our partnership to move from chaos to cosmos also then becomes our agenda in the world. We build communities of welcome and justice. We help to make the world habitable. We create environments in which people and animals can thrive. All of that is God's work of containing and restraining tohu vavohu, the chaos. So I very much think that all of those, and you find that in the Siddur as well, that God is mechadesh betuvo, God is renewing in God's goodness the work of creation, that this is not an event from the past, this is all the time.
So without getting lost in the world of biblical grammar, I want to observe that I think the text itself says a version of what you just said. Let's take just very quickly, for example, Psalm 24, that is the psalm for Sundays. The second verse of that psalm says, "Ki hu al yamim yisada ve'al ne'arot yechonenea," which either means because God established the world upon the water, the chaotic water that God has defeated, or that God establishes the world upon the water, a kind of continuous act of creation. One of the things that some Bible scholars have recently argued is, it's not that we're not sure which one it means. It's that the text is deliberately ambiguous about whether establishing the world is something God did in the past, or establishing the world is something that God does ongoingly in the present.
It's beautiful.
And I sort of love that idea, right? The ways in which it captures this wonderful, I mean, your creation is an activity that is never completed, or that will only be completed in the eschaton, right? In the Messianic age.
Beautiful. And we can only translate it one way or the other, but that's a limit of human language. That's not a limit of the word. The idea can contain both at once, and great literature always does have multiple meanings.
Thank you. Brad, one of the things we like to do on this podcast is conclude with important but quick questions to sort of give people something to take away with them. So I want to ask, standing on one foot, if you will, what do you answer to someone who says, hey, I believe in the Torah, evolution can't be true?
I would say the Torah itself tells us that evolution is true because you can see everything gets made out of what was there before, and everything develops into greater and greater complexity, just like in evolution. God is the source of evolution.
That's a great answer, Brad. Thank you. I love that.
Shai, what would your answer be to that question?
It's a cop-out to say I would first want to know who's the kid asking it and how old are they and what kind of level of sophistication are they on? Because there is no question in the religious sphere that has a generic answer. It's always about who you're talking to. But I think the direction that I would go is in many ways similar to what you've said, which is the Torah never tells you not to believe in evolution. The Torah tells you that God brought the world into being, and evolution is how God did it.
Right.
Brad, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a joy to get a chance to talk to you, and it's fun to do it for lots of other people too.
Thanks.
To all of you listening, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll join us next time for another installment of Many Questions and Answers Withheld. Answers Withheld is produced by Hadar, with special thanks to Rabbi Effie Unterman, Mara Bronfeld, Sam Greenberg, and Chana Kupitz. Thank you to David Chabinsky for recording and editing this episode.